Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. My name is Sharunik Bosu. I am a doctoral candidate in the English department at New York University, and I co-host another podcast called High Theory, which is available at hightheory.net, where we take apart difficult ideas from the academy in very short episodes. Today, we are talking about a wonderful new book titled Rethinking Markets in Modern India, Embedded Exchange and Contested Jurisdiction, edited by Ajay Gandhi, Barbara Harris-White, Douglas E. Haynes, and Sebastian Schwicki. It was published in September 2020 by Cambridge University Press. I also want to add how valuable this book has been to me personally, because I am working on South Asian economic writing. We have two of the editors here with us today, and so we are very pleased to welcome Ajay Gandhi, who is assistant professor at Leiden University, and Sebastian Schwicki, who is the head of Max Weber Foundation's India office at New Delhi. And I will welcome Ajay and Sebastian. I will begin the conversation by asking Ajay and Sebastian about their respective academic journeys, which culminated in this project.
Yes, thank you very much, Sharunak. It's a really nice opportunity to discuss our book. Just in terms of the path to the book, I was trained primarily as an urban anthropologist, and my first project was very much within the field of urban anthropology. It was a study of different groups and spaces and sentiments in Old Delhi. That's a project that I'm trying to finish now as a monograph. And then this project came about through my postdoctoral research, which was done at the Max Planck Institute in Göttingen in Germany. And that's where I had met Sebastian. That came about really through doing fieldwork in a new space for me in central Bombay, a space that I was pretty unfamiliar with. But of course, Mumbai or Bombay is a famously commercial city. It's a city where everybody is hustling. And so as I started to do my postdoctoral research there, I really became very aware in a manner I hadn't been previously of the fascinating way in which exchange and market activity was at the center of so much of social life. So anthropologically, I got more and more interested in the literature within economic anthropology and economic history. And then as I met Sebastian over the years in Göttingen, and we started to talk together and to read stuff together, those ideas came to fruition slowly.
Yes. So from my side, I'm a bit of a disciplinary maverick in some ways. So I originally come from political science and actually political economy. In that way, I've been a South Asianist all my academic career. And when I shifted to Göttingen, where I also met Ajay, I shifted towards economic history. So I've also been dabbling in anthropology to some extent, but nowadays I would describe myself as an economic historian primarily. I started working on a history of extra-legal credit markets in India, in Banaras, actually, from the late 19th century onwards. It's something that where my monograph is soon coming out, finally, after a long period of time. So this is how I approached the topic originally. And so when Ajay and I met, him looking at some topics like black money, as he does in this book, or for examples like smuggling and gold, these kind of questions, it immediately gelled in the way that we knew what we wanted to study. And in many ways, this book is an outcome of that kind of meeting of two people working on sort of similar but still quite different topics.
So as a kind of a natural follow-up to that question, what was the brief for this book itself, and how did it come together? What sort of message you sent out to prospective contributors, if you'd like to share a little bit?
Okay, so maybe I start on this question. This is really what I was interested in when we started thinking about these topics was to understand exchange in the broadest possible way, as something with all its complexity at, like you could say, the operational logics of exchange. So this is how I moved into this particular topic, and I very soon realized how complex this topic really is, so that you couldn't really encompass this topic in any single work that you would read or that you could ever hope to write. So this is how I moved into this particular topic, and then Ajay and I were basically coming up with the idea of like starting a reading group, really just the two of us together, where we would meet and read the significant body of literature that actually exists on this topic, including in South Asia, but not necessarily restricted to that. So gradually, this idea took shape that what we should do is to organize a workshop that would include historians and anthropologists, that would bring these two disciplines together, that would probably even include some people from like neighboring disciplines, maybe even some people who would not specifically normally be associated with the idea of working on markets, but where we thought like their works were actually speaking to the topic of markets. And so this is something that I think really, to some extent, sets apart this book that has now come out last September. So when you look at the list of contributors, you notice this almost immediately. Like, take Pujit Mukherjee, who's a brilliant medical historian, and he's been working for a long time on the history of knowledge. But once we reached out to him, he immediately came up with ideas that could be linked fairly well with the book. And eventually, he settled on a study of what he was calling bazaar grimoires. So collections of magic spells that are used even nowadays by petty traders and shopkeepers and similar kind of market participants to ensure business success. So it's not what you would typically expect when you're opening a book on markets, but all that actually tells you is that many of these books have overlooked quite a number of topics that can be associated with the study of markets. Just as an aside, I will let Ajay speak about his own journey into this book as well. But just as an aside, I have used Pujit's magic spells that he is citing in this volume for teaching purposes. I have been teaching at the Indian Institute of Management in Calcutta for 2 years until fairly recently. So it's a business school. You're teaching management students and confronting them with something like this, with something that, like, yes, all of them knew from their own experience of growing up. They knew that it was very much part of the practices of like business people. But nevertheless, it just seems just so weird. For these students, it's been an experience for me too. So it's really something where we were also learning quite a lot while we were setting up this volume. Anyway, so I will let Ajay speak now.
Yeah, just to fill in a little bit of what Sebastian has said. So yes, at the end of 2016 in Göttingen, we had organized a workshop. And if I remember correctly, that workshop was organized not per se on markets or exchange, but on this kind of idea of the transactional as a realm that we felt had at various moments in the social science and history of South Asia been visible or been important. So, for example, in my own discipline in anthropology, two of the really foundational anthropologists, Frederick Barth and McKim Marriott, who had worked in the 20th century on the region, they had put at the center of some of their major works the idea of transactional culture as something that gives us insight into the cosmological, moral, political, interactional aspects of culture and community. But of course, the economy and the transactional space has radically transformed since people like Barth and Marriott wrote. So I think that as Sebastian and I were in our two-person reading club and slowly, you know, thinking about the kind of archive of reflection on these topics, we really started to get excited by the way in which we could mobilize people that are doing contemporary ethnographic work, empirical work, and also new archival work. To think about these questions anew in a very different economic context now, in a context where many things like, say, mobile spectrum or kidneys and wombs are marketized objects. And so to kind of rethink the question of the transactional, we had this workshop where we had a good number of the contributors to the volume. And then in the workshop itself, what had come out was very strongly beyond the rubric of embedded exchange, which is one of the three pillars of the book. What had come out was the importance or the centrality of regulation, or what we came to think of as the contested jurisdictions of exchange. And so the process of, you know, writing the book and accumulating people really came as over the years from 2015-16 onwards, we were thinking about what are the adjacent ideas and theories and kind of clusters that we can use. And then, like Sebastian said, we reached out to more and more people and found that they were very much had a chunk of their research that spoke to these ideas.
Yes, there's one other thing, like, so even before we actually organized the workshop that this book is the outcome of, so we had actually like reached out to Barbara and Doug, and so reaching out to them, of course, was fantastic for the purposes of eventually like coalescing into this book project for us, because of course Barbara and Doug had all these contacts, all this knowledge about who was working on what kind of topics, and it helped us immensely in the end to set up this volume. So like we had this workshop, we then started really conversing with Barbara and Doug for a long period of time how to really bring together the various contributors that we had selected or that we had asked to contribute to the volume. And it took us the better part of a year actually to even reach the stage where we could confidently say, like, this is exactly the kind of book that we want to propose to a publisher. It was a very intense process of discussing among the four of us how we would actually frame the book, how we would try to bring the various approaches that this book was actually covering together into a framework that was broad enough to actually encompass all these different contributions.
Yes, when our listeners will read this book, it's a massively formidable methodological project. It's amazing how you have brought this project together in this really comprehensive book form. Ajay has already mentioned contested jurisdictions. On that note, and in terms of organizing principles and ways to understand Indian markets, the book offers three thematic rubrics, which are embedded exchange, contested jurisdiction, and pliable markets. Could you talk a little bit about how or what kind of scholarship these rubrics build on and the theoretical and empirical interventions that they make?
Okay, so briefly from my side, these are concepts, conceptualizations of the themes that guide the contributors and actually bringing their own approaches into the book. So this is how I was primarily seeing these three themes that we developed here. Basically, we wanted to have something that would embrace the contributions that are part of this book instead of pressing them into a particular direction. So embedded exchange, contested jurisdiction, pliable markets, these are concepts that are fairly open, that anyone who is working on something that is as complex as a market, as complex as exchange, would immediately know they are encountering this again and again in their research. There is not any scholar on markets who would not immediately understand that, yes, these are concepts that have encountered actually in the process of their research, wherever that research actually is based on and whatever type of market it is actually looking at, whatever aspect of a market this person is actually looking at. So let me just maybe give the example of embedded exchange. So obviously embeddedness has been a concept that has been around for such a long time. It's one of the most fundamental categories when you're speaking of markets. So we needed to very slightly redefine this concept for the purposes of this book in order to create this leeway for dialogue among our contributors. So Polanyi had originally used this concept fairly openly that the social, like the embeddedness, is the social that the market is embedded into. But in substantivist discourse, and to some extent even in later anthropology, this increasingly became associated mostly or primarily with kinship and community, and very obviously it very often is. You can see that in the volume by the contribution of David Ruttner, for example, and let me just add here that was absolutely amazing for someone like me who is from a younger generation to work together with David Ruttner on a book project. His work has always been one of the ways of that I think about defining the standard of doing a history of South Asian commerce. Basically, what we wanted to point out is that, yes, there is no homo economicus. At the same point of time, there is no homo collectivus as well. It's just that embeddedness must be a more open category. In my own work on moneylenders in Benares, on extra-legal credit markets, these are markets that lack very strong collective elements beyond a structure of gossip, beyond information flows on reputations. It's a market that is highly embedded into these reputational information flows, but it's not embedded in other collective elements beyond this gossip. So basically, we needed to open the concept of embeddedness a little bit in order to create room for many of our contributions to actually look at it. Maybe Ajay wants to come in here.
Yeah, I can say something about that as well. Like Sebastian is saying, that I think one of the virtues of the volume is that we are really building off of some senior scholars who have done work in this broad area for decades, not just people like Barbara and Doug, but also people like David Rudner, who've been thinking about the relationship of the social, the political, and economic in ways that don't presume their kind of artificial demarcation. And I think that that's something that is important to highlight, say, in terms of the second rubric you mentioned of contested jurisdiction, because part of the both the intellectual and the political work of, you could say, modern capitalism is to kind of presume a sort of self-regulating or self-catalyzing domain of the economic or transactional that implies that somehow they're naturally separated from the question of the moral or the cosmological or the social. So to give a very tangible example from contemporary India, the farmers' protests, which began last year and which are still continuing at present, the only way that the regulations which were enacted to radically reform the agrarian markets could have unfolded and been persuasive was insofar as they posited that there's a way in which a kind of universal rationality can be imposed on what is a very messy and so-called inefficient sphere of exchange. Now, on the ground, of course, people like farmers very much understand that these are not objective ideas that somehow have some sort of, they're not hovering in the air without any kind of without any interest. They are very interested regulations. And yet part of, you could say, the puzzle of contemporary capitalism in many parts of the world is that we continue to be intellectually and politically indebted to ideas that presume there's a kind of sort of impartiality or objectivity. Now, just in terms of the rubric of contested jurisdiction, one thing we wanted to point out with that idea was that insofar as we think of markets, we tend to kind of reflexively think of them as something that is framed by the state, and the state is understood in a fairly homogenous or monolithic sense, and it's seen as the primary entity which does that framing. Now, if you look at it on the ground, it's very, very different situation. And what we wanted to point to with this idea of contested jurisdiction was to really get people to think about the fact that the number of authorities that have significant sway that can help to shape the way that exchange and market activity unfolds isn't restricted to the state. The state is only one of the regulative bodies on the ground. And so two of the chapters that really nicely illustrate that are Matthew Hull's chapter on lotteries in the Punjab, where he points out the fact that the legal lottery, the state lottery, is only actually one of the lotteries that's on the ground. And in fact, there's a surplus of illegal lotteries that depend on the infrastructure and share many of the norms and conventions of the legal lottery system. But they are, in a sense, he nicely shows, Matthew, how interdependent or codependent these forms of exchange are in the case of lotteries. And similarly, in Jharkhand, Roger Begrich, he nicely shows in a very different context, in the context of both legal and illegal alcohol markets, the ways in which there's a kind of, there's a sort of oscillation and a kind of codependency happening, where you can't simply say that the state is the only party that's relevant in arbitrating how exchange happens on the ground. So we really wanted to bring to the fore the plural or the kind of multiple sovereignties that are really at the center of how exchange unfolds.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, I mean, that's just, if you think about markets, markets are very often depicted in ways as if, as Ajay's put it, they are self-regulating. It's the idea of the invisible hand and all these kind of things basically that leads us to believe that. There's one thing about it that is actually quite interesting, and that is that markets, well, they are not self-regulating, but they are seeking regulation. Markets take place, exchange is taking place in this environment of fairly pervasive uncertainty. That this uncertainty needs to be handled. And for that, you need some sort of governance. And market participants are, in fact, seeking out structures that may help them in creating structures of jurisdiction. And if, for example, a state is coming in, or if the state is removing itself from the governance of a market, these market participants are tapping into alternative structures that are available to them to make markets work. And this is a constant process. It's constantly going on. It's extremely fluid. So there's always a form of authority, of jurisdiction on markets that is being sought. And sometimes these practices of governing the market are made use of simultaneously. Sometimes they are used in parallel. Sometimes they are in conflict with each other. So contested jurisdiction is really highlighting regulation and governance, but it's not a straightforward contest between state and market, state and individual, state and society. There are many different ways in which this can be looked at. So Doug Haynes, for example, is showing how the advent of print advertising shifted the control over the meaning of a product away from middlemen and from the retail segment that was located in the bazaar, and it's shifting it towards the pretty petty producer. So this petty producer could be a trader in the bazaar as well, and in fact he often was, or she, but there's still a process of contesting the authority to define the rules of exchange in this example. And it has nothing to do with the state. It has nothing to do with an abstract market as it is being thought of as self-regulating. It's just various market participants who are making use of the structures that are available to them.
So the question of the nature of the market and the ways in which we can sort of determine the nature of the markets through certain empirical processes, framing that in terms of region, whatever that word means, why would you say South Asia is a good place to study markets, both anthropologically and historically. And how would you say that the dimensions of markets in South Asia direct research towards these three thematic rubrics that you just described?
All right, maybe I come in here briefly before I pass on to Ajay. This is a question that both of us, of course, are very keen to explore. So let me put this very briefly. So this is a book on South Asia. There is no doubt about it. But it should not be taken as a book that only speaks to South Asianists. So what we had very early on decided on that was that we wanted to have a book that was empirically rich. And for this empirical richness, for practical reasons, you need to minimize the amount of translation that actually goes into this. So it's absolutely crucial to understand that the problem actually is translation. So markets are very good at translations in general. They're very good at making things intelligible across structures of embeddedness. Markets that are embedded in social structures, and that means markets, they take on operational logics according to how these operational logics are expressed in various societies. And obviously, South Asia is no different in this particular respect. In turn, when we are looking at it as scholars, we are reproducing some of these the way in which these operational logics are being expressed. But in general, the market is actually quite capable of translating them, of making the differences intelligible. To give you some example, I mean, look at what we now call global capitalism, basically, which is a worldwide economy that is interconnected, that creates very similar intelligibles of how to exchange. Or if you want to think about it historically, look at what we are calling the bazaar economy, which is spanning a major part of the world from Morocco to Indonesia. It's really quite a number of distinct cultural areas that are subsumed there. Let me just use this opportunity to point to a recent book publication by another South Asian historian, Frank Perlin, a book that is called The City Intelligible, which is really dealing very much with these kind of topic. And it's a fascinating book that I really highly recommend. So basically, we wanted to have something that was empirically rich. And if we are constantly translating it to an audience, because we are looking at Africa, we're looking at various regions of the world together, basically, then we have to do the translations. But actually, in the end, I think, and this is a really deeply held belief, that anybody who studies markets is actually quite capable of doing the translation for him or herself. So this is really something where we do not need to make the effort, and we could focus on being empirically rich instead of just translating the different concepts of embeddedness that we are encountering from one region to the other. So just as a final comment before I hand over to Ajay here, and really I'm speaking as a historian here. So this book that we've come up with, it's a book that covers discussions on exchange in South Asia, but in South Asia from about the 17th century onwards. Most of it, of course, is on the last about 150 to 200 years, but it goes back that far. So if you're thinking of a kind of common intelligibility, pre-colonial or even colonial South Asian markets are embedded in much more different societies compared to their present counterparts that you can nowadays find in even in a truly global comparison.
Yeah, just to a little bit expand on what Sebastian has said, I do think one of the book's selling points is that each of the chapters is really empirically very, very original. It's the historians, the anthropologists, whether they're focusing, as Sebastian says, on a time 150 years ago or the present, they're all offering new material to think with. And I think that is that it was very important to us in terms of framing the book. We didn't want to be theorizing at a higher altitude without really grounding the reader in understanding the specificity of regulative practices, of certain moral idioms, of jurisdictional ideas that have had and continue to have a lot of influence in shaping markets and exchange in South Asia. At the same time, I would very much agree with what Sebastian said, that if somebody who is working on, say, West Africa or Southeast Asia reads this book, I do believe they will find a lot that will resonate with those milieus. And that's because in those milieus, the way that exchange and market and transactional practices have unfolded is very much in line with our highlighting, for example, of the multiple sovereignties which have shaped transactional practice. So if you were to write a history of capitalism from, say, the Indonesian islands or from contemporary West Africa, those are spaces that have been for hundreds of years confluences of trans-regional trade. They're as much as South Asia, places where globalization wasn't just invented a few decades ago. But also because of the layering of different kinds of powers over different times and different kinds of tenure systems, different kinds of cosmological practices which have structured exchange, what you find in a lot of places in the global South is a very layered, a very contested arena where exchange unfolds. So I think that's very important to highlight in terms of this book and its legibility by other scholars, because though it is very anchored empirically in South Asia, the rubrics themselves, in terms of pointing to the elasticity of markets, for example, or in pointing to the contested and overlapping jurisdictions through which exchange unfolds, I think that they are very resonant with other parts of the world.
So from the translatability and the sort of easy transferability of your book across many different research situations, I will come to very specific research projects that your individual chapters represent. And my first question is to Sebastian. Sebastian, your chapter is called The Artifice of Trust, Reputational and Procedural Registers of Trust in North Indian Informal Finance, and where you talk about trust as an artifact that comprises a multitude of registers in its handling and creation, and the most important of which, from the perspective of market participants in modern South Asia, relates to its procedural and reputational dimensions. So my question is kind of very specific. If you can speak a little bit more about how local reputational registers work parallelly with system trust, as you put it, on a national level. And have you found parallels between local and national political cultures that influence this process?
All right, I'm not so sure about the last part of that question, but let me elaborate a little bit. I mean, to some extent, actually, this is the wrong kind of question. In the way that I approach trust, at least, and I'm aware that there are other scholars who do this differently, but in the way that I approach this topic, trust is always something that is rooted in an individual decision-making process. It's an expectation that you have to convince yourself of, that your expectation is actually right. And in that way, it does not really matter whether you are actually having a reputational form of trust, or as it's more common to put some things that are somewhat similar, like a personal trust. This is how it's very often used in sociological literature, and I'm actually having some discussion with this in the chapter that I do not need to repeat. In great detail, reputational trust is somewhat different. That is one thing. If you are looking at system trust, it's still something that actually starts at the individual level. And it's simply the fact that it's shared among many people, or that it's resembling the way that other people are trusting in a way that can be aggregated by scholars like us, that makes it system trust in that way. So what you're actually trusting, what you've convinced yourself that you should trust, that is still something that is very much your idea of something. It's your idea of something that is a representation of something that you believe is there. And so in that way, basically, like there is a kind of problem in the question as you posed it, basically. There is not so much a difference between the local and the national level in what you're looking at. It's simply a different way of applying trust. So this is why I had been speaking of trust as an artifice. It's for that matter, actually, just in order to draw the line back to the study of markets, basically. So markets themselves are an artifice. In many ways, it's a way of ingenuity among people who are participating in them to make themselves believe that they can actually predict what is happening in the future. This is what makes it possible for you to actually start exchanging. And this is really something that very strongly necessitates to look at trust. Now, of course, I approach this topic from the study of extra-legal financial markets, of money lending, which in India is a criminal activity. It's at least when you're lending to relatively poor strata. So it's a market that cannot actually depend on any forms of state intervention. It cannot enforce credit conditions or obligations through the violence of the state. So instead, you have to find some other ways of actually making yourself trust what is happening. And you have to do this under really quite adverse conditions, because these are highly exploitative markets. I do not want to mince words about this. So it's something that I never believed before I actually started studying them. The level of exploitation is just incredible. But at the same point of time, you can still seek something in these markets that you can trust. Now, you can find something systemic. And this is what, for example, the Indian state in its modernizing project on credit markets was trying to propagate. This is what in India is still called organized banking, is actually working on. It's a set of procedures imposed by the Indian state in this case that actually makes it possible for people to trust. And sometimes you notice that this trust might be misplaced. So this is something that, for example, in a recent crisis in India is very much visible, when the Indian state decided to demonetize high cash denominations and force people to actually put all these money, this cash into the banking system, overloading the banking system in the process. This trust actually becomes misplaced. So at that point of time, you notice that in the end, trust is just that. It's an expectation. It's something that is an artifice. It's something that you actually have convinced yourself you should actually engage in. So system trust can be very much a wrong individual assessment. And the same goes for the kind of reputational logics of trust that are operational in the extra-legal segment of the market. So the moneylenders, the petty moneylenders that you can observe doing their work in these kind of extra-legal credit segments, they work on reputation. They work on a system of reputational gossip that governs these markets. But at the same point of time, there is just a very, very high rate of failure, as there is in all segments of any market. It's something, again, where the way that scholars are thinking of markets is often misguided to some extent, because we tend to look at the success stories. We tend to look at what leaves traces. And failure normally does not leave as many traces as success does. So there is quite a lot of failure that actually shapes these artifices of markets and the artifices of trust that actually make up these markets.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sebastian, for clarifying that point. And it really opens up your chapter a new way if you think about trust as something that fundamentally originates at an individual level. Ajay, your chapter is titled Black Money in India, Fighting Specters and Fostering Relations. And as you explained right at the beginning when we began, you have been working on black money for quite a while. So I was wondering if you could give us a brief history of the idea of black money as an anti-national entity and in many ways a kind of draining force which succeeds the so-called colonial drain once upon a time.
Yeah, thank you, Sharnak. Just to pick up a little bit off of what Sebastian was saying, that one of the really interesting things when I reread the volume and look at the chapters, including Sebastian's chapter and my own, is that I think all of the contributors are very alert to the constructedness of how these processes operate. That is to say that though we bandy about the idea of, say, an Indian market in a singular sense or a stable sense, and though we think of things like money as somehow guaranteed and sort of having this kind of foundational stability, as Sebastian has just said, they are really, really constructions. And so as an anthropologist, one of the things that I started to get very interested in as I did my postdoctoral work in central Bombay was the kind of ordinary idioms, the symbolic invocations that people used when they spoke about market activity or exchange activity. So those people that work on modern South Asia will probably be somewhat familiar with the fact that spaces like the bazaar and practices like money lending, like Sebastian has just discussed, they've typically been associated with sort of unsavory characters. They've been seen as potentially nefarious activities. They've been seen as even subversive things. And so because I think commerce and transactional activity, it's regarded with a lot of moral ambivalence, that's something that's also quite prevalent when it comes to things like black money. So black money as an idea and as a, you could say, as a sort of as a repeatedly invoked kind of symbolic entity, black money has for decades been quite prevalent in sort of the public sphere in many different through many different political and social periods. It's continued to be to have different connotations as being subversive of social health, to be stymieing national development, and to get to your question, to be indeed anti-national. So how is it that something that we see as sort of a means to conduct exchange has come to acquire this this kind of bogeyman character? And that's what I was trying to get at in the first part of the chapter when I talked about black money as a specter that one has to fight. That if you, it's really interesting that if you look from the mid 20th century till the present day, including this period of demonetization, which Sebastian mentioned, and which was a very traumatic and disruptive event in the last few years, black money is continually seen as sort of the reason why India is not developed, why there's not national prosperity. It's a kind of thing that you can point at just to say that, okay, there's this potential national prosperity or national wealth that has been drained or has been diverted. And so what's fascinating about black money is that because it has this, it's a very wide-ranging idea, it can be applied to everything from sort of petty bribery to one-off kind of instances of sort of official bribery to, say, large-scale diversion of funds. And this I mentioned in my chapter about how repeatedly government figures, officials, academics have suggested that there's massive amounts of Indian wealth that's located in Swiss bank accounts or in vaults in Zurich. Now, what's for me fascinating about the persistence of that idea, of its repeated invocation, is that it's something akin to a very old idea in economic anthropology, which is the idea of a hoard. So in most societies, comparatively across time and space, you've had notions of a kind of repository of wealth. It may be jewelry, it may be cattle, it depends on the society. And that hoard is seen as the repository of a kind of inalienable wealth. And I think this is what's really troublesome about the idea of black money, is that it connotes precisely a hoard, a national hoard that's being ransacked, that's being diverted. And so the symbolically or metaphorically, and this is also how it's written about in, for example, reports or academic publications, the image one gets is of sort of a nation that is being bled dry, whose kind of vitality is being drained. So it's fascinating just to see the symbolic and moral connotations that attend a transactional sphere that you would ordinarily not see used in such kind of hyperbolic and sort of high temperature terms.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that when you said, you know, the nation is being bled dry, that's exactly the image that is used in that Naurji uses, and the economic conversations before independence. It continuously refers to this image and this metaphor of bleeding as one of which is draining the nation of economic vitality. So it's curious how that idea has traveled. My final question for the day is sort of bipartite. Firstly, where do you see both of you scholarship in this broad area is going, is at this time, and of course relatedly, what are your own plans in terms of, projects that would continue this work and also develop and derive from this work?
Ajay, do you want to come in first?
Sure. About this, very broad area, it's very important to reiterate, Sharnik, that we are very much building on a set of scholars that have in economic history, in economic anthropology, in heterodox economics, in development studies, been trying to think about these issues and been thinking about them and their intellectual and their political stakes. And as I've mentioned before, the current farmers' protests. Sebastian has mentioned the demonetization controversy. So I think one of the really takeaways from the volume is that it's very resonant and very it's very relevant to what's happening in a contemporary sense in South Asia. I do not think that I think the intersection of regulation, of morality, the both the durability of certain transactional idioms and spheres, as well as their mutability and their flexibility. I think the things that we're trying to point to in contemporary South Asia, they're not going to go away anytime soon. And if anything, the book is coming in at a moment where I think that we really need to have more conversations about that. I do think one of the curious things about the commercial or economic sphere in South Asia is that it's generally been seen in scholarly or intellectual terms as perhaps not as lively or interesting or relevant as, say, religion or ethnicity or politics. But I do think that, you know, that conversation needs to be more people that are doing more detailed archival and ethnographic work and furthering what's happening here. Just in terms of two things that, as I reflect on the volume and on things that interest me personally, that I would like to see done or to perhaps have a hand in doing myself. I'm very fascinated. As an anthropologist, I've always been really fascinated by the conceptual or the symbolic dimensions of social life. And I think that as I reflect more on the volume as a whole and on other scholarship, I do think there's more to be done in thinking through the ways that longstanding, very anchored idioms and categories and concepts around, say, risk and speculation and arbitrage, how those have had quite a bit of vitality and sometimes intersected with more modern or more state-directed notions. So I would actually really like to see maybe the fields that we are broadly working in engage a bit more with the kind of conceptual history of these ideas, and to really also see, for example, in Sebastian's chapter, he's working a little bit with this idea that's very pervasive in North India, in Hindi, of vishwas, of trust, and the way that trust is operational, both as a kind of regulatory idea, as a regulatory principle, but also as a moral principle. And I think that there's much more to be done in kind of unpacking those spheres, because if you look at not just the Hindi public sphere, but at many other public spheres in India, India is a very vast and has a very complex set of overlapping spheres in the sense those languages are very vibrant and they still haven't been, I think, sufficiently probed. So that's one area that I think that more can be done. And I would also think that more can be done in thinking about the resonance of some of the things we're pointing to beyond this, the territorial sphere of India itself. So one of the things, I guess, that's in the volume that we're doing is we are using, of course, India as a frame, as a geographical frame, as a political frame, as a regulative frame. But if you look at India historically, at the ways in which, say, circulations of transactions was done, whether it's of finance and investment or debt or even things like labor markets with the history of millions of indentured laborers going overseas from the 19th century, I do think there's much more to be done in sort of thinking about India itself as a more elastic category in an economic sense, right? So how did mobility and regulation and the flows of objects, people, things, ideas, how did they all come to be in this kind of more expansive sense? I think that would be something that there would be definitely more that we can do about that as a scholarly community.
Maybe just briefly to add to this. So there are so many different dimensions that you can look at when you're looking at markets, when you're looking at exchange. And really something that Ajay just said basically is very important here. There is no reason why it should only be looked at from particular disciplines, why it should only be looked at from within the idea of this being a kind of discrete sub-discipline. So I was pointing out Pujit Mukherjee in the beginning of this interview, but look at one of the other contributors that we're having, Andy Rodman, who's a very well-known scholar of Buddhism. But he's also worked on the Bazaar in Benares for a long time, and he knows so much about these markets. And there's something really refreshing about the way that he, coming from religious studies, is actually approaching the idea of exchange, the idea of a market. So I think we should also try to get away from the idea that once you're working on economic anthropology or economic history, then this is the only thing that you're working on, and you should try to reach out to other scholars. And then, after all, I mean, these markets are so complex that there are so many angles that you can look at the market from. So what about, let's say, the aesthetics of exchange or generativity or something like that, basically? Look at retail as not only the passing off of goods from one end to the other, basically, but you're looking at it as something that is based on communication that actually establishes the meaning of a particular product in this exchange, in this communication between the retailer and the consumer. So these are questions that I would definitely like to take up at some point of time, and we'll definitely keep on working on topics like this also in the future. And we're trying to bring together people again and again to work on these kind of topics and try to take a very broad approach to it.
That is a wonderful note to end on. And thank you so much, Ajay and Sebastian, for talking to us about this wonderful new book. And congratulations again on the publication. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharnak.
Thank you, Sharnak.